Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The Bush administration has received information it did not expect. The 1991 Wetlands Manual would result in the loss of half of the nation's wetlands. We'll have the story. Also this time, writer and photographer Mirella Ricciardi. From the air, she had a very good view. The forests in Brazil are still burning.
Before landing, about an hour before landing, I looked out of the window and I saw the whole world on fire. As far as I could see, there was smoke and fire. And there was so much of it that although we were very, very high in a Boeing 707, the smoke was permeating the cockpit.
The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. President Bush does not want this story told. We'll tell it anyway. The following are quotes from a series of documents we received recently pertaining to President Bush's proposed changes in classification of the nation's wetlands. Referring to the actual 1991 manual that would be published identifying wetlands, one paper said, quote, "The 91 manual is extremely confusing, even to the most experienced wetland delineators." The writer goes on to call the proposed guide a disjunct manual. This same paper concludes, "The 91 manual deviates from accepted wetland science," end quote. Here's another one. "We believe the proposed revised manual has serious problems and serious implications." The writer goes on to say, "The 91 manual is technically deficient, difficult to use, and increases the number of incorrect wetland determinations," end quote. Sounds like pretty critical stuff from an environmental group, right? Wrong. These papers, which the Bush administration would just as soon we did not have, which in fact were kept secret until leaked to sources in Washington, papers which still have not officially been acknowledged or published by the White House, these papers were written by a consortium of government agencies headed by the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Our source, wetland scientist Scott Firebend of the National Wildlife Federation, says the documents confirm what his and most other environmental organizations have been saying all along.
Anywhere from 30 to, in some instances, 100% of areas that were previously identified as wetlands in 1989 would, under the president's proposal, completely be removed from federal protection.
Between August 2nd and October 4th, 1991, a series of field studies at 450 sites around the nation was carried out by the Environmental Protection Agency, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Soil Conservation Service of the U.S. Agricultural Department. The field tests were coordinated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Scott Firebend.
And I think it's important to footnote this comment with the fact that it's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers who is the lead agency in compiling these reports and whose name appears on most of the cover sheets. And it's significant because if you look back at the history of this issue, the Corps has been anything but a friend of wetlands, and now over their name you see a tremendous number of bells and sirens and red flags going off because of the impact that the president's proposal is going to have.
Working independently in the separate regions of the nation, the four federal agencies, says Firebend, found three common themes.
One, that the impacts to wetlands would be tremendous. Two, that the document is very difficult to use and is not user-friendly, which flies, in fact, in the face of one of the objectives. And third, the fact that there's no scientific basis for what's being proposed. Those themes don't just occur in one or two regions of the country. These are themes that are woven from east coast to west, from north to south. It's a common finding in all the field testing groups that went out and evaluated the manual. So it's very clearly the document has tremendous deficiencies, both from a technical and from a scientific perspective.
It is estimated 100 million acres of wetland remain in the United States. That's half of what existed just 200 years ago. In fact, a federal manual issued in 1989 found we are losing upwards of 500,000 acres of wetland each year due to agricultural practices, real estate development, oil and gas development, and in the case of coastal tidal zones, due to erosion and sedimentation. Both the 1989 and the proposed 1991 manual were meant to stem the tide, as it were, of wetland loss. However, in looking to save wetland, scientists and the administration have been at odds over what is properly called wetland. Though scientists had accepted and praised the 1989 definition, the American Farm Bureau, the oil and gas industry, the American Association of Independent Home Builders, and the real estate agents lobby, among others, felt that definition captured too much land. To settle the dispute, Vice President Dan Quayle headed a team from his Council on Competitiveness to rewrite the definition. This fall, says Firebend, the four agencies mentioned took the proposed new manual out to sites previously listed as wetland and applied the new criteria.
What has happened is the results, the responses to the questions that were originally given to those agencies, i.e., is the document scientifically correct? What will be the geographic impact in terms of the reach of the new definition? The responses have been overwhelmingly condemning of the document. And so now the White House realizes they've got the wrong answers to the wrong questions. And so they don't want to make these summary documents available, I think, because of the embarrassments they're going to face. And one person told me recently that, in fact, the White House was considering developing a new set of questions to send back out to the agencies in hopes of getting, quote, the right answers this time around.
Vice President Quayle, Firebend recounts, offered his own quick and dirty definition of a wetland.
At one point during Mr. Quayle's deliberations, he said, well, hey, how about if we say if it's wet, it's wet? That was kind of the Quayle test that we now see being translated into, this ecological disaster that's certainly going to take place if the administration prevails on it.
Objecting to the 1989 manual, the administration sought to redefine when a tract of land is considered wetland. The proposed new definitions would require an area actually to be inundated, not just saturated, with water for 21 consecutive days and during the growing season. The difference between a puddle of water inundating your, say, kitchen counter and a saturated sponge that you would use to wipe it up. The analogy holds even one more step in that, like a sponge, a true wetland, according to scientists, periodically does go dry while maintaining the soil and vegetation's characteristic of a wetland. Furthermore, there are many other determining factors, soil and vegetation type, for example, that define whether a tract of land is a bona fide wetland. For reaction to all this, we contacted the Vice President's office, where we reached Jeff Nesbitt, Director of Communications for the Vice President. Nesbitt, as you might expect, has a different view of the chronology of events.
Back in 1988, when then-Vice President Bush gave his no net loss wetlands pledge, generally people agreed that there were in the neighborhood of 100 million acres of wetlands in this country. In early 1989, the EPA and three other agencies, without any public comment, without private property owners having a chance to comment on it, changed the definition of a wetland. They issued a new manual, and by our estimates, and again, I don't have hard numbers, potentially tens of millions of new acres were redefined as wetlands. So the Vice President's office and others began to hear complaints from people in 1989 and 1990. And it was on that basis that we undertook a review of that manual, basically with a goal of eliminating confusion prompted by that unreviewed 1989 manual.
To the claims now documented by the four investigating agencies that possibly as much as one half of the nation's wetlands would lose federal protection, Nesbitt offers this explanation.
Let's say you have an increase from 100 million acres up to some number, you know, above 150 million acres, and I'm not saying that those are the numbers because we don't know, and then you have a drop back to the 1988 levels or 1987 levels. Yes, there is a loss from the 1990 and 89 levels, but there may not be a loss when compared to the 1988 levels when then Vice President Bush made his pledge of no net loss of wetlands. And I think that distinction has been lost in the debate here.
Which is why the president and his advisors apparently do not see the field test results as conflicting with his campaign promise of no net loss. We discuss this with Timothy Searchinger, an attorney with the Environmental Defense Fund. He put it quite simply.
The president or the administration, with the president's blessing, although who knows how much he really understood, but decided that it really didn't want to meet the no net loss pledge, and that the best tactic seemed to be to redefine wetlands so that you could claim that you were protecting all of the wetlands. It's just that all of the areas the wetlands you were excluding, you were no longer going to call wetlands.
A variation on the fox and the grapes, with the president saying something like, "Politically, I cannot continue to protect all the wetlands. The lobby groups are pressuring me. So I'll change what I call wetland and then protect 100% of what's left." A couple of final points. Gleaning through the Corps of Engineers report, it seems that all areas of the country would experience a severe reduction in the number of acres under federal protection. For example, Michigan. Following the 1991 manual, Michigan would lose up to 4 million of its remaining 6 million acres of wetland. Louisiana. Losing 50 square miles of coastline already each year, Louisiana would lose 4 million of its 9 million remaining acres of wetland. North Carolina. 5.5 million acres remain in that state. Under the 91 proposed manual, 1.5 million acres of that wetland would be lopped off. Some states would lose more than others. In fact, 29 states, West Virginia, for example, would lose all land currently designated wetland. Finally, the public comment period on this proposal has now been extended until December 15th. Nesbitt, with the vice president, says all further comment has been reserved until that time. He says the administration would hope somehow to reconcile the reports turned in by the federal scientists. This is Bruce Robertson. The idea first surfaced in 1990, the 20th anniversary of the first Earth Day. Elevate the position of the Environmental Protection Agency to White House cabinet status. The bipartisan bill in the U.S. Senate, sponsored by Senators John Glenn, Democrat, Ohio, and William Roth, Republican, Delaware, would do just that. That bill, S-533, passed October 1st. The issue has been introduced in the House of Representatives by New York Republican Congressman Sherwood Bollert. The bill, H.R. 3121, would create a Department of the Environment. Bollert says the rationale for this is very basic.
The environment is a priority concern of the overwhelming majority of Americans, and yet the top person in the agency that has responsibility for the environment at the federal level is not a cabinet-level member. In other words, when the president sits down with a policy council in that cabinet room, the Environmental Protection Agency man is not there. That shouldn't be. He's a subordinate. That's wrong. Secondly, when our EPA administrator travels abroad, as so often he must because environmental issues are international in scope, he does not have the cabinet or ministerial standing that his counterparts do. As a matter of fact, when Bill Riley went to a recent meeting in Europe, there were 36 nations represented. The U.S. was the only one that had an environmental chief that was not a cabinet or ministerial person. So I think we should give EPA the level of attention and status that it deserves so it can do a better job for the American people.
Bollert says this is particularly pressing in light of next year's International Environmental Summit meeting in Rio de Janeiro. The United States needs to show up with an impressive and genuine portfolio. The change would create a Department of the Environment with a Secretary of the Environment. However, this would not mean any radical changes in budget or staff, says Bollert.
What you've got to do is get a new sign for the door, but he's going to have the same office, he's going to have the same staff, no increase in personnel, basically the same responsibilities. But what we're doing is making the Environmental Protection Chief a secretary so he will have equal footing in dealing, as he often does day in and day out, with the Secretaries of Agriculture or Commerce or Defense or State. As he deals with them now, he's dealing from a position of subordination. I want him to deal as an equal because I think the environment is critically important. It is to the people I represent, and they want to have the strongest possible advocate in that job.
New York Congressman Sherwood Bollert. The House sponsored a similar bill last year, one that did not win favor in the Senate. It would have created a Department of the Environment, but would have delegated an independent Bureau of Environmental Statistics, separate from the White House executive powers. No president, Democratic or Republican, would have signed that measure. Though the action has passed in the Senate this year, sources in the Bullard office tell us the measure has stalled in a committee chaired by Michigan Congressman John Conyers. No further action is anticipated until Congress reconvenes next year, at which time sources say the bill in the House is likely to get loaded down with amendments, not likely to win the president's approval. The current measure reportedly does have the support in the White House as well as from many environmental groups. We'll let you know what happens in 1992. This is Bruce Robertson. America still finds itself without a national energy policy. The Senate recently defeated Senate Bill S-1220, the Johnston-Wallop National Energy Security Act of 1991. Bob Reha visited with Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone, who played a major role in derailing the legislation. Senator Wellstone shared his thoughts about the Johnston-Wallop bill and the future of U.S. energy policy.
Senator Wellstone, a first-term Democrat, was among a bipartisan group of lawmakers who denounced the legislation as environmentally unsound. They succeeded in blocking Senate consideration of the bill.
I would give a lot of credit to people on the outside. People always think that it's sort of just inside the House or the Senate. Just the environmental groups and citizen action groups really went all out and made the phone calls and contacted senators, and they were very, very important in our being successful.
Senator Wellstone says the challenge now is to fashion an alternative to the policy advocated by the Johnston-Wallop Act.
I don't think we have an energy policy in this country, and I think over the next 20 years we have to make a transition and we have to reduce our consumption by 10% at least, and we've got to triple renewables, and we can do it. But that's not what this bill was about. So now we have to really introduce alternative legislation, which we're going to do.
Wellstone contends a sound national energy policy must pass the test of common sense and reflect the demands of the American people.
When the Department of Energy held its hearings around the country, people came in and they talked about wind and they talked about solar and they talked about efficient energy use of the offices and at home. People talked about the importance of domestically produced clean fuels like ethanol, and that is the transition that people wanted to make. That has to be the foundation of it.
Although it's unlikely, the Johnston-Wallop National Energy Security Act could resurface before Congress adjourns for the year. Wellstone makes it clear he'll introduce his own proposal yet this session and in 1992.
I hope that some of the proposals that I want to make, where the focus is really on efficient energy use and renewables, will be combined with the work of some of the other senators I've worked with, and we will come up with a really credible, workable energy program. We will do that for certain.
Opponents of the Johnston-Wallop Act believe they have created an opportunity for a successful energy policy, an effort to wean the country away from its dependence on fossil fuels, a policy Wellstone believes must be respectful to the environment, community-based, and labor-intensive. At this point, it's unclear if a majority of his Senate colleagues will support such action. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Bob Reha.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils, based in Billings, Montana. Photographer and writer Mirella Ricciardi says she went into the Brazilian rainforests to create her own version of cave paintings, to leave a written and photographed record of a vanishing civilization for generations to come. Her cave wall, as it were, is an oversized book of photographs with excerpts from the journal she kept as she traveled in the rainforest in the summer and fall of 1990. Her intent was to spend time with the Campa, the Maruba, and the Yanomami tribes in western Brazil. Long before she arrived in the first village, she began to see evidence of rainforest destruction.
Appalling. I've only one word. It's appalling. Luckily, there's so much of it, but there's already an enormous piece of it which has been destroyed. And when I first went out to the Campa, when I was flying to the Campa, I flew to a place called Rio Branco, and which is in the southernmost part of Brazil. Of the Amazon. And Before landing, about an hour before landing, I looked out of the window and I saw the whole world on fire. As far as I could see, there was smoke and fire. And there was so much of it that although we were very, very high in a Boeing 707, the smoke was impermeating the cockpit of the aeroplane. And we could smell the smoke inside the aeroplane to give you an idea of the extent of the destruction. I don't need to say more. And this is just in one state. It is now just daily, just creeping. It's like a galloping cancer cell. So I don't know how long it's going to take to dry an ocean, because that forest, if you look at it from the sky, is like looking at the ocean. There are parts of it which is, it's like the sea. It goes all the way to the horizon.
Ricciardi says there is some progress to report. For one thing, the Brazilian government, under its new president, has taken some steps to curb the burning and encourage other kinds of commercial uses of the forest. For another, the forest people themselves are taking action.
Several years ago, they had this great big tribal meeting at Altamira. You must have heard about it, to which the whole of the international press went. And although for thousands of years all the tribes in the forest were warring against each other, which is incredible. I mean, it is incredible that even in the forest people war against each other. But they were. And they were killing each other, and they were stealing each other's women and children and territories. And however, when the white threat started encroaching on them, there were some intelligent and more emancipated Indians who came to the conclusion that the only way that the Indians could defend themselves from the onslaught of the white was to unite. So, to unite to fight the common enemy. So they united, and so they called a great big gathering in a place called Altamira, to which all the chiefs of the different tribes came. And they founded the Union of Indian Nations, known as UNI. And they elected an extraordinary charismatic Indian, very, very intelligent and very, very articulate, to head it. His man called Ailton Krenak. And Ailton Krenak is the head of the Union of Indian Nations. And it was during that gathering at Altamira that all the chiefs of all the tribes were able to air their grievances about each other and to agree that the common enemy they were fighting was greater than their differences. So they decided to drop their differences and to unite. And it is that only hope that they have to fight the enemy.
The destruction of the rainforest is bringing with it not only the disappearance of untold and unnumbered species of plants and animals, the forest people are disappearing. It is estimated once 10 million Indians lived along the Amazon and its tributaries. Today, that number has declined to 200,000 and going down. Mirella Ricciardi is author of Vanishing Amazon, a book of photographs and written narrative describing the author's journey and experiences in the rainforest of Brazil. The book is available from Harry N. Adams, publisher, New York, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, do drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, number 100. That's 1-800-767-1929, The Environment Show, number 100. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.